Well, I'll go ahead and get started here and state this is Shu Bartholomew, and she's our special guest tonight. And what she is going to go over is the legalities and pitfalls of homeowner associations. And Shu, would you like to give us a little bit more information about you and what we're going to cover?
Thank you very much, Melody. First of all, I'm not going to go over legalities because I'm not an attorney, and I cannot give legal advice. I can talk about what my understanding of the legal process, and I will be happy to do that. But in terms of, you know, let's get that out of the way. I'm not an attorney, so
you would have had to say that anyway.
I say that to cover myself every single day. I am not an attorney. I cannot give legal advice. I've been doing this for about 20 years. I host and produce my own radio show, which is in its ninth year of production right now, and we talk about the issues surrounding homeowner associations predominantly. We do cover property rights because I think property rights are in great danger in this country. You are at risk of losing what we have, and we're losing a little bit every day. It's sort of like an erosion, you know. You give up a little bit today, they'll come back for a little more tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day. And so I'll be happy to talk about associations, property rights, anything that you want me to talk about.
Okay, now, is this pretty much the scope of where you focused, or does it need to branch out in other areas at all?
It is the scope that I have focused on, and I'll tell you why. The simple reason is because there's really not a whole lot of information out there. What you have is, let me go back and give you a little bit of history on associations. See, associations have been around for a long time. They started back in the 1800s, actually. And these associations at the time were exclusionary in nature. In other words, we will take this little city block and we will say that, you know, we will not have the Irish. No Irish allowed to live here. No Catholics, no blacks, no Chinese, and we're going to keep it all nice and white and sparkly clean. Well, that's the way the initial associations were set up. They were designed to exclude people rather than allowing them to move in. Well, the court struck that down as being unconstitutional. So any covenant that's still out there that's recorded against it that says that, you know, no Chinese or no Irish or no whatever is illegal. Mm-hmm. There you go. I'm giving you legal advice. No, but the courts have found that it is illegal and you cannot do that. So those covenants are void. They don't work. You cannot enforce them. After World War II, when there was a boom in the economy, and the economy was on the upswing, people started buying cars, they were building roads, and people wanted to find the American dream. They wanted to leave the urban centers and bring their children up in the country where the air is fresh, where they had room to run around, where they could have pets and they could be out playing ball and they could sit on the front porch and talk to the neighbors. That was the essence of the American dream. That's what Norman Rockwell drew all those years, and that's kind of what people wanted. Now, there was a problem, because once the roads went in and enough people were able to afford to move out to the suburbs found themselves being overwhelmed. Local municipal government said, oh, you know, we can't provide services to all these people. So they went to the idea of privatizing some of the stuff. We'll just, all right, so you don't have to maintain the streets, local government. We'll set up a homeowners association. The homeowners themselves will maintain it. They'll pick up their own trash. They'll pay a contractor to pick up the trash, so the tax, their tax dollars will not be part of, you know, getting trash service or snow removal or street lights or local parks. And this was designed initially just to help local municipal governments and get started, just to get them over the hump as they dealt with this massive influx of people. What they told the people was, hey, this is great because it'll protect your property values. You won't rely on City Hall to come in and clean up, you know, pick up the trash. You'll do it yourself and you'll do a better job. And your streets would look nicer and it will protect property values and your values will go up. And so the people bought into that notion slowly. They bought into that notion. When local municipal governments realized how financially lucrative this entire proposal was, that, you know, hey man, we're getting all this tax money and we just don't have to provide all of the services that those tax dollars were initially designed to provide, then they started mandating them.
So does this mean that they're kind of getting double, the people that are in these associations are really kind of getting double taxed?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what it means.
Okay.
Now they're mandating them. A lot of the areas, especially outside the major metropolitan areas like Washington, D.C., where I am, Denver, Colorado, where you are, Chicago, Illinois, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Miami, and even out in the countryside, York, Pennsylvania, a lot of these places now say, oh, Mr. Developer, if you're going to build a development here, you're going to have to set up a homeowners association. Sometimes there are actual mandates. It's in the code. If you build anything, you've got to set up an association. Sometimes they're de facto mandates. Mr. Developer, you want the permits to build a development? Well, I don't see a homeowners association here. So they kind of tie up the permit process and they make more demands. But I think more and more municipal governments are actually putting in the actual mandates in their governing documents or in their states or their local ordinances.
Are there kind of like quasi homeowner association type requirements, like some before they even let them do subdivisions, they make them do certain things that might come under normal homeowner associations, but they don't require them to do that? Does that make sense?
That's what the mandates are.
Okay, all right.
It basically says that you have to have a homeowners association. No ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Oh, okay.
When homeowners, in 1970, there were about 10,000 homeowners associations across the country. These started being built, remember, around the 60s when they started doing this? So by 1970, there were 10,000 associations nationwide. They think it's an estimate. Today, there are 300,000. So you can see how much they've grown in the last not quite 40 years.
Right.
And that's probably largely because of the mandates. A lot of people think that some people will actually look for a gated community in some parts of the country. Those are very popular. They believe that if they're in a gated community, they're going to be safer. And a lot of people think that, gee whiz, you know, we'll end up with all of these fancy amenities that we otherwise couldn't have, like swimming pools and tennis courts and golf courses and privately owned ponds and lakes and marinas and horse trails and, you name it. It just goes on and on and on. What they don't realize is that their homes are being used as collateral for all of these amenities. So you buy a home, your neighbor gets on the board, your neighbor has no sense at all on, no business sense whatsoever. Your neighbor is going to be deciding how to manage and run, in some cases, a multi-million dollar corporation, which is exactly what an association is, especially the bigger ones with a lot of amenities. If for some reason there's a shortfall, if for some reason they're not able to maintain these, guess what? They have the right, the authority, some cases by statute, by law, in some cases, and usually in their governing documents, to special assess you. So you're in there, you've got an assessment of a few hundred dollars a month, or whatever the assessment happens to be, based on the size of the association and the number of amenities and so on. And all of a sudden they find they need, we need a few hundred thousand dollars here. So they have the authority to come to you and say, Melody, you owe us $20,000, $40,000, $95,000. And we want it by the end of the month. We want it by the end of the year. We will be very generous. We'll allow you to give it to us in three installments, $30,000 each. And if you can't pay it, guess what? They can foreclose, sell your house to collect that money. They can oust you.
So, these homeowner associations can kind of override constitutional issues and things of,
What they say is that, and I don't buy into it, but what they say is that when you buy into an association, you willingly and voluntarily give up your constitutional rights.
Wow.
In other words, you are moving into a contractual relationship. It's a government by contract, and this is what you agreed to. You said, oh yes, I think it would be fine and dandy to have someone tell me that I may not put a sign up in my yard, that I cannot fly a flag, that I cannot put up Christmas lights at Christmas time, that I cannot have friends over, whatever the restrictions and prohibitions are. They're telling you that it's a contractual relationship. Now, here's where their argument breaks down. And that is when you end up in a situation where for the last 30 years, all construction comes in a mandatory membership association. Let me give you an example. I live in Fairfax County, which is the largest county in Northern Virginia outside of Washington, D.C. We have had mandates since the early 1980s, so everything that was built from 1982 to today has to be in a homeowners association. The estimate is that 90% of all housing is in an association, and only 10% is not in an association. Now you think, all right, so there's 10% of the housing out there that's not controlled. Well, here's what's happening to that 10%. They're going in and they're rezoning it because these are older subdivisions where you have a quarter of an acre lots, a third of an acre lots, and they're saying this is bad use of land. We're not using the land judicially. So what we're going to do is we're going to rezone it. We're going to zone it from R3, which is a third of an acre, to 100. That means 100 units per acre. So they're coming in and they're tearing down existing older uncontrolled housing and replacing it with condos and townhouses and all of that stuff. So even that small percentage is dwindling. So you've got on the one hand everything that's being built, all the new stock is in an association. So that number keeps increasing on an annual basis. But the stock of non, you you know, non-controlled housing is going down because it's being replaced with, you know, with controlled housing. And the Thilo decision plays a key part in this, because if you had a house that was, let's say, pretty close and right across the river from Washington, and it sat on half an acre, maybe it was, you know, maybe it's a 50, 60, 70-year-old house, and you said, hell no, I'm not going to sell it. Why would I let, you know, why would I let some developer come in and tear this down and put a high-rise condo on my property? I don't think I want to do that. Well, what the Kelo decision did was give the government the right to foreclose or to condemn your property by eminent domain and take that property and give it to a developer to develop it, because having 100 luxury condos on that half acre would generate infinitely more tax revenue for the county than it would if you allowed that half, you know, that single family home on half an acre to remain. So those are the forces that are working against it. So you cannot, you know, homeowners associations are a big problem, but it goes hand in hand with property rights. You've got to be able to defend and protect everything.
Boy, and that's really getting eroded right now. Now, where's the relationship between, or is there a relationship between planned unit development?
Yeah. A planned unit development simply is, it's just been designed as part of a homeowners association. You know, they'll have, yeah, they'll have all of the elements that are required for a homeowners association, for instance, the increased density. And then they'll have, you know, maybe throw in a couple of amenities like a clubhouse, parking, the grounds, the open spaces, the, you know, maybe it might include nothing more than a fountain someplace in a circle. But that will be part of a private association. It will not be part of the city. The city's not going to maintain it. And here's, you know, Gilbert, I don't know if you guys, if you know what Gilbert, Arizona, if your listeners know, it's small. It used to be a really, really small town outside of Phoenix. It's grown exponentially in the last 30 years. And they have the mandate. You have to have, you know, you have to have the association. And I've had their mayor on a number of times. I've talked to him. And his take is, why should the citizens pay for, with tax dollars, pay for the landscaping in a private community? Well, I think that's kind of putting the horse, you know, the cart before the horse a little bit, because the developer is required to provide these open spaces that are privately owned. You know, if you didn't require them to do that, then there wouldn't be this problem of, gee whiz, well, you know, they've got all these plants, and if we, you know, if the city took care of it, then the city would have to pay for it. And those flowers are only in the private enclaves. So, I mean, we've created this absolute disaster. And instead of saying, this isn't working, let's take another look at it, but until we figure out what we've done and whether we want to continue down this road, let's have a moratorium on this building. They haven't done that. You know, they're basically taking away rights that you have. They're taking away choices. You don't have an option. If you said to me, you know, I really don't want to live in an association, sometimes it's really, really hard to find something that you can move into, that you can buy. And then you're always at risk of having it condemned because the county or the city or the town or whoever might decide, gee whiz, you know, we could get more tax dollars for that property if we condemned it.
What do they do in the areas where they have low income and they have this sort of setup? When
you move out. So that some places want you to have, you know, some places want the developers to set aside housing for low income. But the thing is, and this is another one of my pet peeves.
Oh, we've got this one big time. You know, when they sell these, it's saying we're putting in affordable housing, which I still have to question whether it's affordable or not. And then take away more rights for the people when it comes to down the road for them. It's kind of hiding within, you know, these HOAs that for low income, when it's not really low income, is what I see.
One of the big problems I think we're seeing with the whole meltdown is this low income or affordable housing scams, because there's this sense in this country that everybody has to be a homeowner, and whatever happens, we have to make them a homeowner. Habitat for Humanity is out there building associations. Habitat for Humanity is building associations, which means that you're taking people who have no experience, no money, no track record, no nothing, and you're putting them in housing, and you're expecting them then to run a corporation and handle budget for things like street maintenance, trash removal, snow removal, street lighting, and all of this. It's not fair to them to put them in that position. Now, they've put in sweat equity, they've done the work, they've helped build the houses, they've helped develop the association and all of that. After all that, their houses are being held collateral for the success of the association. The association is run by people who did not have the ability to become homeowners without this big help. One of the big problems we're seeing with the Freddie and Fannie and all of that is the loans they make. I mean, you know, if you went in and you said, I wanted to buy a $100,000 house, I don't have any money to put down. And well, they'd give you a first and a second and an adjustable rate and, you know, we'd refinance it and don't worry about it. You just get in and they'd make the money as cheap as they possibly could initially. 2 years' time, your mortgage has gone up considerably. You cannot pay it.
Right.
And that's when you lose your house.
Right. Unfortunately, what we see going on right now, though, is they're trying to put a lot of the blame on these loans and that sort, when there's a whole lot more factors that are hiding underneath the surface there that have nothing to do with how these loans are structured as much as the people that are running them. But
there's a lot of corruption. I agree with you.
Right.
But 20 years ago, we did the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
20 years ago, we you think we'd learn our lesson. But
now they just come up with a new name, and then they baffle us with baloney, and we
right.
Fall for it again.
Dazzle us with you know what. That's right.
So, I mean, at one time it was, you know, trying to come up with these planned communities out in the suburbs, and now they're trying to come back and get us back into the cities and calling it smart growth as opposed to, you know, trying to get out from underneath being, you know, on top of each other, you know, right with your neighbor, you know?
Well, don't get me started on that. That's going to come back to bite us. I really think it is. It's not all it's cracked up to be.
You mean smart growth?
Right.
Or, yeah.
Urbanism, the new, planning and all of that. It's really not cracked, you know, all it's cracked up to be. You know, when I sort of gave you a very brief overview when I said back in the 60s and 70s mm-hmm. when they started mass-producing associations. One of the chief people was a guy by the name of Byron Hankey. He was with the FHA, and he was an urban planner, and he looked looked at, you know, when people started moving out of the urban core and they moved out into the suburbs, suburbs were being built on a checkerboard style, you know, where all the streets ran east, west, south, north.
Mm-hmm.
And you see some of the oldest, you know, some of the cities that grew up at that, in that era, that were built in that era. And he went back and he said, well, you know, this isn't very pretty. We want nice streetscapes and, you know, you want nice meandering, rolling streets and cul-de-sacs. And he sold that based on the fact that they would be safer because, you know, that was the end of the road, basically. It wasn't a through street, so mm-hmm. you could go and live on a cul-de-sac or in a residential area, and there'd be a pretty, you know, winding street that you could walk, and sort of every turn would have its, you know, a surprise in your house and all of that. Now, with the new urbanism, they're coming back and saying, oh, no, that's not good because that takes up too much time. And, you know, we don't want that. Now we're going to build everything on a grid pattern because then it's easier to walk. And you're going to have, you know, Main Street down the middle, and you're going to have the houses around there, and then behind them you're going to have the schools and all of that. So, you know, in 30, 40 years, we've sort of flip-flopped back and forth. We've gone from having meandering streetscapes, cul-de-sacs, destinations to, well, you know, that's absolutely no good. We're going to do the grid because we just want to move. And, you know, it's like we really don't know what we're doing. We just do things. We don't know what we're doing. We come up with all these shoddy ideas of why this is the way to go. Didn't work.
So... how old are the like the New York City high rise associations? Are they as old as the HOAs or older or what?
They're probably older because a lot of those are cooperatives. In New York City they have a lot of co-ops, a few condos, but a lot of co-ops.
What's the difference between a co-op and a
in a condo? In a condo, you own airspace, and you own a portion of the physical structure. So, let's say you have 5 acres, and you have a high rise, and you have 100 people. So, whatever the building and the land is worth, you own 1/100th of that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you own a proportion of that. In a co-op, it's a corporation that owns the building, and it's a corporation that owns everything, basically. And you're a tenant. You have what's known as a proprietary lease. And you own shares in the corporation. You never own anything, not even airspace.
Really?
Like you do in a condo. You own shares in a corporation. And that is why if you go into a co-op in New York City, the board interviews prospective buyers before they will allow you to buy into that. You know, remember Nixon was turned down because he tried to buy a co-op in New York City, and, you know, the board said, we don't think we want you here. So they wouldn't let the president move in.
Okay,
but they have that kind of power, yeah.
Okay, so they own it, and then on the condos you own a portion of.
Right. Okay. What you own individually is airspace. You own the inside of the units
mm-hmm.
that you have, and plus you own a portion. You know, it's prorated, depending on how they figure it out. I mean, you could have, it could be broken down into shares. It could be broken, you know, it could be just one share per owner type of thing. So it depends on how it's structured, but that's what you own.
Okay. So, well, there's so many different directions you can go with this. I can't believe it. It's like trying to break down the structure of a city and start figuring out, you know, what works and what doesn't.
Yeah.
And so where do you find most of the problems that kind of arise with these associations?
I I think that you share a lot of horror stories. And in fact, if any of your listeners are interested, you can set up Google Alerts and put in the words condo association or homeowner association. And on a daily basis, you will get 5, 10, 15 articles from around the country.
Wow.
On the horror stories that are going on, be it, people losing their homes because the association tries to collect. All right. Let me lay something out.
Okay.
And I think the two areas that I find particularly troubling with associations, one of them is the power to fine people, and the other is the power to foreclose. In some states, that's a non-judicial foreclosure. Non-judicial means that you don't have to go to court to prove anything. You can just go ahead and sell someone's house on the courthouse steps.
So then there is more power in these associations than there is,
the government.
Right.
Yeah. One of the big things we're seeing is that if you live in an association, there are dues that have to be paid. I'm going to advise everybody who's listening right now, don't screw around with those dues. Pay them. You don't want to end up having to play catch-up, because here's what happens, Melody. You send in a check. Let's say that your assessments, your monthly dues, or however it is, let's say it's $100 a month. If your check is late, or if you don't pay it, you owe that $100, plus they'll add interest, plus they'll add penalty. So that $100 is no longer $100 right from the get-go. Whatever the date is, it starts adding on.
Now, is that written in these, has to be written in the rules, or is that
it's in the rules.
Okay.
It's not the rules, it's in the covenants. It should be in the covenants, it should be in the bylaws, it should be in your governing documents. Make sure you know what it says.
Okay.
Because not all associations know what it says. They sometimes arbitrarily do things because, it makes more sense than what the rule, what the governing documents say. So make sure you know what it is. Make sure you pay them. Sometimes people get so frustrated because the only way they have of holding the association accountable in their minds is to withhold payments. I'll get people who call me up and say, I didn't pay it because they're not picking up my trash like they're supposed to, so the trash is piling up. Or I've got potholes in the street and nobody is doing anything about it, and so I said, all right, until you fix it, we're going to withhold it. Or you're charging me for something that I don't know what it is, so until you figure it out, I'm not going to pay you. Don't do that, guys. Pay your assessments. Because if you don't, that $100 will end up being thousands of dollars. And here's how that works. You send in for whatever reason, you may be a few minutes late, you may have skipped a payment, you may have whatever the issue is. They will then add interest and they will add penalties. And so now that $100 is $125, $130, whatever it is. The next month, you send in $100. They will take that and they will apply it to the penalties and the interest. First they pay off the interest, not the $100. First they pay off the interest. So then you now still owe assessments. So then they add on another penalties, the late fees and interest, and this goes on for a while. Okay, they don't let you know about it when you only owe them $25 or when it's easy to figure out what the problem is. They don't tell you that. It just let it accrue, and then one day you get a dunning letter from an attorney saying you now owe $3,000. And you go, how could that possibly be? So you try to figure out where the money came from, how they arrived at that. Well, how they arrived at that was that they hired an attorney. The attorney pushed the print button on his computer, printed a dunning letter, and mailed it to you. And so, those costs, those additional costs are tacked onto your bill. I've had people who've gone in and said, all right, right now, I'm going to write you a check. How much do I owe you? So they'll look at the amount, they'll give them the amount, they'll write the check, and then months later they come back with, you owe us, another dunning letter, and they're back up to thousands of dollars. And how did that happen? I came to the office, here's the thing, here's a copy of the check, here's what was said. How could you possibly do this? Oh, well, the person who was, who was in the office at the time did not realize that there was an additional 10% that had accrued. So, we just tacked it on and added it on and added it on. And it's a vicious cycle. It's a never-ending cycle. The lucky ones will get notice and they'll be able to pay it off and be able to put a stop to this. If you don't pay it off, if you can't pay it off, if for whatever reason you're not told, if they suddenly don't have your correct address and they mail it to another address or a different name, and that has happened, then they can foreclose. Then they can just go to the courthouse steps and sell the house and get rid of you.
Okay, now, do the larger ones seem to abuse this more than the smaller ones?
I think it's all across the board.
It's all across the board.
I think it's all across the board. And at the heart of all of this, I think, is the industry attorneys. There's a national trade organization called the Community Associations Institute, CAI.
Mm-hmm.
And their members are the attorneys. Their members are the management companies. Their members are the CPAs, the pool people, all of the people who make their money off associations. Associations are a $40 billion annual industry. So in addition to making your mortgage payment, in addition to paying your taxes, homeowners, you are paying an additional $40 billion a year.
Wow. Okay.
If you live in an association.
Now, what you're saying then is that we've got a lot of third parties out there that are now being an entity in their own right, servicing these associations.
Right.
Okay. Now, what happens if, say, this city goes bankrupt, or something happens, or the association goes bankrupt, or something along this line? Does that put them in jeopardy of being bought up or having a foreign entity come in?
Yes. Okay. They can get, and another thing that you want to watch out for is embezzlement.
Right.
Because associations are required or are encouraged, and they really ought to have money put aside for future replacement costs. For instance, having streets privately owned, these are expensive.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of money. Or in the case of a condominium where you have common roofs and the association is responsible for maintaining and repairing and replacing, these could run in to hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so the prudent way to deal with this is to put money aside and to say, all right, the roof is, we're going to need a new roof in 20 years. We estimate it's going to cost $20,000. So we're going to have to set up a fund, and we're going to have to put $1,000 a year into it until we get to the 20-year mark so that we have that $20,000 we think it's going to cost us to replace it.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got all this money sitting there, you've got homeowners who are inexperienced, don't know what they're doing, they're sitting on the board. If you have a board member who says to the management company, I want to see what you've got, and I want to see, you know, I want to look at the books and records, we want to make sure that everything is audited on an annual basis, that board member is usually chastised and told that they're micromanaging, and then the rest of the board members jump on his or her case and say, hey, you know, you can't do that. These are professionals like God. We're paying them all this money, and, you know, they're managing things, and so just leave them alone. In Virginia, there's a case now. They're investigating a $2.2 million embezzlement. There's another $1 million out of Florida, and you know, I'm just throwing these out at you. These are current ones. There have been hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars that have been stolen from associations.
Okay, now are there ways to prevent that?
Yeah, you have to have board members who are willing to sit on there and who are willing to go through that and who are willing to micromanage if necessary, but to provide the adult supervision that needs to be provided. And the homeowners have a responsibility to make sure that the board is doing what the board is supposed to be doing. So what you have is, you're paying $40 billion a year to have someone come in and tell you how to live. And then you're supposed to have the homeowners watching the board members, watching the managers. It just is kind of, that's the only way it's going to be prevented, and it's kind of a stupid way to live.
Well, what about in a situation where, my understanding that I run into this situation where someone says, well, you can't have so much money set aside that you have to, or they expect you to spend it down. And it is like you said, so what happens when you have something go wrong, then they come back and nail you with an assessment. And so you can have this kind of an ongoing argument going there where...
Who told you that you cannot have that much money sitting around?
Well, there was somebody that was under the assumption that, you know, that was that was part of the legality, and I had to, you know, I didn't know, so I guess I need to go myself and start looking into the, is there some kind of, you know, the name of the codes or anything that we'd be looking at, or is there such a thing, or what?
I think you could look under your state codes. I think you can look in your own governing documents. Folks, if you live in an association, the first thing you need to do is get a good copy of your covenants, your declaration, your deed, whatever you want to call it, and it comes under CC&Rs, it comes under a number of different names, but it's all the same piece of paper. Go to the courthouse and get a copy from the courthouse, because only the recorded documents
are binding,
are valid. And the reason for that is that by recording them in the land records, they're available to anyone who wants to look them up. And by doing that, they constitute what's known as constructive notice. That's where the idea that this is a contractual relationship comes from, because you have a responsibility to yourself to make sure that you know, when you buy a piece of property, to make sure that you know what it entails, what's recorded against that property, what you can and cannot do. And all of that should be part of the public record.
Now, is there a good template out there that people can go to? Because even I've seen where in my area they just copy somebody else's documents. Well, they may not apply to that particular group down the road. And what can they do about it if they don't apply?
I'd say ignore them. Again, I'm not an attorney. I'm not giving you legal advice. But if they don't apply, they don't apply. I mean, if it says that you have to put money aside for a fountain and you don't have a fountain, then you can't really put money aside for a fountain. But
you're also saying they do need to have some kind of a a monetary fund available and audited, and so that it's so that they have something there to cover the major costs.
It, you should. Either something else. Now, I'm going to give you the other. I think that you should have it there. I'm going to give you the other side of the argument. And the other side of the argument is that if you have the money there, then you're going to have people embezzle it. And so they would rather, there's a number of people out there who would rather make sure that there is no money out there so that it can't be embezzled. And, you know, it's a compelling argument.
Right.
And if you live, if you've got a lot of money and you live in a very upscale area and you're writing a check for $50,000 any given day is not going to be a problem for you, then I say, hey, that's okay. I can't write a check for $50,000 because the street needs to be repaired. I can put in an extra $10, $20 a month or whatever it is along with everybody else to go into a fund.
Right.
That will be available when the street needs to be repaired.
What about having a situation where, okay, when they do have those major expenditures that are going to take place, then it has to be reviewed by the board before it's ever spent, and that if they do write checks, possibly, that maybe there's more than one signature or something along the line so that sort of situation can be, you know.
You should go out to bid.
Okay.
And the board should request a bid. And you should get at least, in my opinion, at least three bidders. If you're going to be doing something major like a street or, you know, if it's mm-hmm. something that's going to take a considerable chunk of your money, I would invite the bidders to come and give presentations. You know, you don't have to reveal the amount of the bid. That should be sealed.
Right.
Okay? Because otherwise you're not going to, you know, it's going to compromise the integrity of the bid. But what you want to do is the board members should know how much, but it shouldn't be, shouldn't be generally known what the amount of the bid is. But then have the bidders come, invite the homeowners to come, invite them to ask questions, have the bidders make their presentations, and get input from the homeowners at an open meeting, and then have the board, and this is one of the few times that I think that the board should convene in private to discuss the financial thing. Because, look, if you have, let's say you're going to do the roof, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to replace the roof and you live in a condo. And you got three bids, or you got five bids, and you decided to narrow it down to three bidders because those are the ones who really addressed your concerns. Invite them over. Have people ask questions, especially the people who are going to be roofless for a while if they're at the top of the building, and have them get comfortable with what's going to happen so they know what to expect, so they can address any concerns they may have, you know, that somebody may have a situation that nobody knows about. And then you go in and say, all right, now here's, you know, what this bidder's going to do, this bidder's going to do, and then you talk about the monetary numbers. If you disclose the money up front, then what's going to happen is bidder A is going to try to underbid bidder B. They're going to know where they stand financially. And it's not always the lowest bid that's the best one.
Okay.
And, you know, sometimes you want the middle one, sometimes you want the high one. Maybe that's the one that's going to give you what you're asking for, and it will be worth it in the long run.
Okay. Now, so keeping these funds and being able to watch over them, having your, whether you enforce or don't enforce certain aspects that don't fit your association, but that can be tricky in its own right, I would imagine.
What are you, I mean, you must have something in mind.
Well, in an instance I'm aware of is, okay, so it's written into the condo association that everybody has, trash is paid by the association. Well, actually, in this case, not everybody, you know, they recycle so much or they have such little refuse that they, you know, just didn't, you know, I mean, because essentially when you've got a small group and you're pretty much charging, you know, the expenses that, you know, come in and go out, you're not trying to add a lot to it, you know, they're getting penalized as opposed to the ones that utilize it. And so, you know, in an instance maybe that it isn't as necessary, and if you just go outside of it and everybody pays for trash that wants it, you know.
But it's part of your assessment.
Right.
I mean, that's part and parcel. That's the way it was set up. It's like, you know, the streets or any other common, you know, common mm-hmm. expenses, the trash was part and parcel of that thing. I mean, if you're not spending a whole lot on trash, you don't need to collect as much.
Well, that could be the case.
In assessments. And, you know, sometimes it's not going to be 100% fair. I live in an association that's got 1,300 homes. It's a mixture of townhouses, two to one. About 800 townhouses to 700 townhouses to 300, or anyway, whatever the math comes out to, 800 to 400, basically, townhouses to single-family homes. Now, the townhouse streets are privately owned. So the single-family homeowners say, hey, wait a minute, you know, why are we paying for streets that we don't use? Well, the townhouse people say we pay taxes for the streets that you live on. Some people say, well, you live right on the lake, and yet we don't, and we're paying for lake maintenance that you benefit by. Then there's trash. People in single-family homes tend to have a lot more trash than people in townhouses. So the townhouse owners say, hey, you know what? If you want to just separate things out, which they can't do without amending the governing documents, but if you wanted to separate things out, then you're going to have to pay a bigger chunk of the trash bill. So it kind of evens out. I mean, it's the way it was written. It was some people, you know, get on this end and others get on the other end, and they all grouse and nobody's happy about it anyway. But that's kind of the way it was set up. It's part and parcel of the whole structure of an association.
Okay. Well, we run into this on, you know, several little things, and so we didn't know, since it is such a, you know, the one that I'm talking about is such a small association, it was kind of like a, you know, kind of like an oversight, but you're saying that that really should be, you know, okay, that it avoids a lot of problems in other instances, but there's in this particular case, they really did copy. There's a lot of legalese in there that it's just like whoever writes these things up, some of it is just like, you know, some of it is just like,
hey, before they had the computers, they would type them up and they would copy from copies, and you know how if you copy a copy, you lose some of the integrity of the copy, and they would copy. Mm-hmm. Some of them were actually illegible, but they were recorded anyway, because there were copies of copies of copies of
right.
copies.
Right, and I think that's kind of what happened in this particular case. And in a sense, what if there was some really good, well-written HOAs, can a group get together and just create new bylaws or association rules or whatever?
Yes, you can. Let's talk a little bit about the hierarchy of documents, shall
okay.
we?
Okay, all right.
You have the declaration, the CCNRs, the deed restrictions, the covenants, whatever you want to call it. That is the document that is recorded in the land records. That document runs with the land. It details what can and cannot be done with the physical structure of the property. In other words, no clotheslines can be hung on the property. And, you know, whatever the rules and conditions, restrictions are that pertain to the house, to the unit, will be found in this document. The next document down is the bylaws. The bylaws basically tells you how the association is going to be run. We're going to have a 3-member board. We're going to have a 5-member board. The board is going to consist of, the annual elections are going to be when, and it's basically how. It doesn't tell you that you cannot paint your shutters. That's, you know, that goes under the covenants. This simply deals with how the association is going to be run. Then you go down to the lowest rung, and that is, some people call them rules and regulations, some people call them policies. It depends. These are the rules that the board members who have been granted permission to adopt. And these limit them. There's a limit. They can't go in and make up any old rule that they want to, much to their own chagrin.
And that was, again, which document now?
This is the rules and regulations, policy resolutions. It depends on what you call them. And these are the... Every association has something different. These are the ones that the board members... These are the rules that the board members make up. Now... Go back to...
All right, so you're saying that with the documents that...
There's a hierarchy in documents.
Okay.
Let me recap.
Okay.
You have the covenants, and the covenants run with the land. They pertain to the actual physical buildings, the land, the houses. This is where you will find such restrictions as colors for the front door, no additions, no changes without an architectural control committee approval, no clotheslines, no TV antennas, although that's kind of been thrown out the window by the FCC, any of the restrictions that pertain to the building itself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's where you go in. That's part of the contract. That's part of what you're supposed to know before you go in. That if I buy this house, I cannot paint the door green like I want. It's got to remain brown. Whatever's in there, that's where all of those. You know, all of those restrictions are. It also gives the board, you need to know that, because it also gives, it's your rights as well as your restrictions. It's your rights. It kind of restricts what the board can do. The next one is the bylaws. Next down is the bylaws. The bylaws basically tells you how to run an association. You have a board of so many people, the president and the duties of the president and the powers of the president and, you know, on and on and on and on down the line. That's just how the association is run. Last on the bottom rung is the rules and regulations, policy resolutions, whatever your association happens to call them. And these are the rules and regulations that the board is allowed to adopt. Now, usually, and go back to the governing documents, go back to the covenants to find out.
So the covenants are the basic, cornerstone documents.
That's basically it. And
okay.
If there's a conflict between a rule and regulation, and let me say this: the rules and regulations, usually the board is allowed to make rules and regulations pertaining to the use of the common areas, they cannot suddenly come up and say, we ban flagpoles in private front yards. They don't have that authority. Okay, that authority, that is a covenant. And there's, if you want to ban flagpoles, there is a way of doing that, and the covenants will tell you how to do that. It usually takes a vote of the members, and quite often a supermajority vote, which I'm very, I'm adamant about, I'd like to see it 100%. It's never 100%, but, that's what I think it should be in order to change it. Board members quite often exceed the scope of their authority when they adopt rules and regulations because they think it needs to be done. And, they don't have that authority. A good judge will throw it out if it goes to court. If there's a conflict between the rules and regulations, the policy resolutions, whatever it is, and the bylaws will supersede. If there's a conflict between the bylaws and the covenants supersede. So there is a hierarchy. It starts with the, covenants and goes on down. So boards are limited, and they don't always know that, and sometimes they do, and they don't really care. So it's up to the homeowners to really know and understand what they're in for.
Uh-huh.
It's not carefree living by any means.
You're saying that there's a procedure to go through.
There is. The governing documents, the covenants will tell you, what it takes to amend the covenants. There's a provision in the bylaws to tell you what it takes to amend the bylaws. And then one thing we didn't talk about is state law, because a lot of states have come up with laws regulating associations. Some of those laws are not really good for homeowners because they were lobbied for by the industry, and it just helps associations get more powerful. Those laws usually are known as enabling statutes. That simply means that it gives associations the authority to do it. It will not, they can take away from the contract. For instance, if you're governing...
And even if the contract was before the state did the law, there's not a grandfathering thing or clause or anything?
They can take away. Let me put it this way. If your governing document said that you could not have single women living in the condo, and the law said that is unconstitutional and will not. So basically, it can take that away. It can say no, you cannot do that. Perfect example. Virtually every governing document said you cannot have antennas there on site. The FCC came back and said that's a violation of First Amendment rights. So every covenant, every restriction on antennas is no longer valid.
Does that go for satellite dishes?
That is satellite dishes.
Oh, okay.
That is satellite dishes. Now, what they did say, because the associations whined about it, and they said, we want to be able to tell them where to put them. But basically, the bottom line is they cannot prevent you from having a satellite dish. They can tell you where to put them as long as you get reception. They cannot tell you to put it in the basement where there's no reception and out of the way. But, they can have some say in it. So that's an example of how the government can take away. The government cannot come in and say that you will provide, for instance, trash removal if that is not called for. It's not in your governing documents. It cannot say that you can be fined if it's not in your governing documents. What it will say is you may fine as long as it is in your governing documents, which means then you have to go back and amend your governing documents to include these provisions. Whenever I hear from people who say, our governing documents are so outdated, we really need to rewrite them. Be very careful, because the people who are going to rewrite them are going to be the attorneys, the members of CAI, who are going to come in and say, well, when these governing documents were written, you didn't have the right to fine and foreclose non-judicially. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to give you that right when we rewrite the governing documents. So 9 times out of 10.
They make them worse?
It's worse for the homeowners, yes.
Okay, no, but do you have to have those type of attorneys write them? Can that not be written as a with oversight from an attorney that...
Well, the attorney's going to sit there and he's going to smile benevolently and he's going to say, oh, you want to make sure that your governing documents comply with the law.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're an inexperienced, I don't know, you may be a brain surgeon, not know diddly about the law, you're going to say, oh, we don't comply with the law. Oh, well, then we have to comply with the law. You know, it depends on how it's put to you, unless you know what's going on. Unless you have someone on the board who says, you know what, we don't want those powers, we don't need those powers, we've been in existence for 40 years, we've done very well without those powers, we don't want them. All we want to do is clean it up like this. But that doesn't happen because you have... You know, you're going to turn to an expert in the field, and unfortunately, the experts in the field have a vested interest on how that governing document is written. You know, it's like giving it to the fox and saying, write the rules to protect the hen house. You don't do that, and that's what's going to happen.
Now, what
because
if...
the fox is the only one who knows how to write.
Okay, now what if you had the documents drawn up, and that you voted on them as whether you want to keep the old or have new documents that suited you, you know, suited the association. Would that be a possibility that you might be workable?
Well, you say it's going to suit the association. Yeah, I want something that's going to suit the association. But again, unless you know,
mm-hmm.
unless you've got the experience and unless you know what you're doing, you could end up in worse trouble.
Right, but wouldn't you, say in your instance, couldn't you not recognize good documents from bad ones?
Yeah, but I've been doing this for 20 years. I'm not on the board, so I mean,
right,
my board
right.
could right now be amending the documents. I don't know about it. And there have been a lot of, you know, there have been a lot of attempts. I mean, when I've seen them, I've put a stop to them, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, say like in my area, condos weren't a big thing. It's relatively new here, or HOAs, and being, you know, they didn't used to be an overwhelming part of the community. And so what was happening is you had a lot of contractors come in here and just look up the documents because they knew they had to have them and found some documents somewhere and just, you know, filed those, as opposed to really having to know and seek out documents that were really good ones. And that's the only reason why I'm presenting that to you is I realize that there's probably attorneys out there that are exactly the way you are, but there's got to be ones out there that aren't, that are really...
Yeah, there's very few. This is one of the problems. This is such a new area of the law.
Mm-hmm.
Because when associations first came on, there was... Well, my Star 70 didn't work.
Oh, well, you are allowed a bunch of them.
When associations were first being built, they did not have laws regulating associations. They did not have any experts in the field. The CA, remember I was telling you about the Community Associations Institute, the CAI attorneys now brag about it. I mean, they've been celebrating their 25th anniversary, 30th anniversary, whatever, and they brag about, gee whiz, when we first started out, we were divorce attorneys, and, you know, and divorces were down, and so we got into this field, and I'm going to quote this, we wrote ourselves a recession-proof career.
Oh, my gosh.
So these are the people that you're going to be asking. These are the people who are knowledgeable. One of the big problems is that homeowners who find themselves in litigation with their associations have a very difficult time to find attorneys to represent them. For one thing, there's no money in it because the homeowners don't have the money that it's going to take.
Mm-hmm.
For another thing, a lot of the attorneys don't know the area of the law. They do not practice in this area at all.
Well, see, then we should be putting the word out to the attorneys, hey, you guys need to come up with an association that is outside of that particular one, so you do have something to...
There are a handful of these attorneys. I have talked to them. I have interviewed them. I do work with them. I often get calls from attorneys saying, you know, I've got this... ordinarily, I would not take this case, but I've got this long-standing client. I've done a lot of work for them over the years. I've been their personal attorney for 10 years, 20 years, and they now have this problem, and I don't know what to do. I don't know where to start, and they call me, and as I said, I'm going to repeat this, I'm not an attorney. Don't give legal advice. But, you know, but that's the situation we find ourselves in. There are some attorneys
mm-hmm.
in some parts of the country, and I know who they are, and I've talked to them, and I've interviewed them, and I'm sure there are others that I don't know. But again, quite often, there's not the money.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who's litigating, and she's been in years of litigation. She can afford it. She has spent $1 million on legal fees.
Well, I was going to say that I bet there's got to be a number of wealthy people out there that get caught up in this because they're the ones that seek those sort of associations out.
You see, what they do is... Again, the industry, the CAI attorneys, what they'll do is they'll play these economic games with you. They'll push you up against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
They'll make sure that they run you out of money before you ever get to court.
Mm-hmm. But they do that across the board.
They do that across the board, but again... You know, the homeowner is at a disadvantage. The homeowner is on his or her own against the entire development. Their neighbors are afraid to help them out. Their neighbors are afraid to come to them and say, hey, you know, we'll back you up, we'll contact the board, we'll do this, we'll do that. They're afraid of retaliation.
How would they get retaliated on?
Because if you're sitting there and you've got a development and the board members are going crazy and they've decided that they're going to go after you because you've got a pink flamingo in your yard or you've got a mezuzah on your door or you put up Christmas lights or you've got a flag or you've got 12 rose bushes and you're only allowed 8, whatever cockamamie petty idea they've got. You want stupid, I'll give you examples of sheer stupidity. But if they're going to go after you and they're going to fine you and they're going to threaten to foreclose on you and they're going to refuse to accept your assessment checks, which they do, by the way.
Really?
And then if you... And then if you... And then if you end up going, hey, wait a minute, this is my neighbor, you're being too harsh on my neighbor, they'll go after them. They have. They'll do that because this is your quintessential bully situation.
Okay, now, you have to be aware of then this is kind of a socialism on a microcosm, is it not? So that we have brought in socialism into this country via the Homeowners Association.
You know, a lot of people do feel that it is a form of socialism. It doesn't work, whatever it is. It really and truly is not working. I told you I'd give you petty.
Okay. And I'm sure that it's out there plenty.
I interviewed a guy out of Florida. His name was Kent. I can't remember his name. And his association, his board members, came up with a rule that if you were going to walk your dogs on community property, that you could only walk them on 4-foot leashes. Now, think about what kind of a person it takes to decide how long your leash can be.
That's probably, there's a metaphor.
You want to say there's a metaphor for that?
Well, meaning that, I mean, it kind of ties in with how much leash people have in some of these communities.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Well, in this guy's case, he is an amputee. He lost one of his legs. He has two small dogs. And when he goes out, he cannot, I mean, he's got an artificial leg, but if he had the dogs on 4-foot leashes, first of all, he's tall. And so the dogs are going to be right underfoot.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got, you know, really small ones and really tall guys, you've got to strangle the dogs. it doesn't work if you've got a big dog and a short person. A 4-foot leash is fine, but you know, it sort of, you have to wonder. There was a kid in North Carolina, I think. And she had decided that she loved animals. She was going to raise money for the SPCA over her summer vacation. She was going to do that by setting up a lemonade stand. Unfortunately for her, she lived in an association, and unfortunately for her, the board closed her down. I mean, just, you know, again, what kind of petty people?
Right, and see a lot of times, you know, you could have people going into these associations and they have one, you know, everything's fine and dandy at that point in time in their life, and then something takes place and changes, and now all of a sudden, you know, there isn't any flexibility for them to, you know, absorb a change. Say, like, you know, maybe they were married and the spouse died and the person couldn't afford to, you know, stay alone in the house, and there was something, you know, against, you know, having somebody that...
That happens a lot. You have someone... Here's another thing. A lot of these 55 or older communities, senior communities,
mm-hmm.
That's basically the only one that you're allowed to have that sort of doesn't violate the fair housing laws. You can have senior developments. Senior developments say you have to be 55 years or older, or one of you has to be 55 years or older, whatever. You've had instances where a guy lives in one of these things, and becomes a widower, and then marries someone who's much younger, and then he dies, and the wife is not quite 55, so they try to kick her out of her own home. You've had instances where a child has gone to live with her parents because they were getting old and they needed help. It was the only home she's had.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but when her parents died, they wanted to oust, you know, they want to oust them. They want them out of there. Another one of the most idiotic ones is that virtually all governing documents say that the purpose of the association is residential. In other words, it's, you know, that you have to be, you know, you have to use the house for a residential purpose.
And meaning, when you're saying, did you say idiotic too?
Yeah,
because
when they wrote those governing documents, I think they were thinking in terms of, in the old days, slaughterhouses, you know, you can't have that. They didn't want you to do, you know, maybe run a business out of it where you'd have a lot of traffic in and out or whatever. There was a case out of Florida a number of years ago where you had young homeowners who were foster parents. Because the state paid them part of the expenses for taking care of these children, the board decided to oust them out of their association, out of their homes, because they were, quote-unquote, running a business. There were stories, I mean, there's some stupid, idiotic ones. There's a story, a couple of stories out of New York City. In a cooperative residential, the super is, you know, the people go up and down, and the super went in to spray one of the units. And when he went in, the owner was sitting there, one of the residents was sitting there on the floor. She was a medical student, and she had her books open, and she was sitting on the floor studying. Mm-hmm. So he went in to spray the unit, and when he walked out, he went down and he invoked. He said that she was cited because there was a rule in their governing documents that said you were not allowed to sit on the floor. Yeah, you want stupid? This is
the part where I was talking about earlier, was saying being able to go into some of these covenants or whatever it is to amend somebody's ludicrous, you know, ideas.
Yeah, that's a rule. That's not, okay. No covenant is going to have that. You don't have to enforce. I mean, your governing documents will say you may enforce. It doesn't say you shall enforce.
Okay.
It says you may enforce. That means you don't have to. It means you can if you want to. You've got the authority to do that. If it's stupid, I wouldn't bother with it. I mean, why would you do that? Another one. Co-op. New York City. Neighbors notice this guy's always home. How does this guy make his money? They find out, oh, this guy's an author. He sits at home and he writes his books. They said, oh, you're using it as commercial property. You may not stay home and write a book. They forced him to go out and rent office space to write his book. So he had to leave his unit, go to work, sit down in a small office all day, do his writing, and then come back in the evening.
So in other words, they had the ability to interpret what a commercial interest was. Is that what
they're doing? Anything. Yeah, I mean, they found somebody who had a website, and they decided, you've got a website? That's commercial. You may not have it. So, you know, move. You're managing your website from your home. That's a commercial industry.
And you don't consider that socialistic?
Oh, I do. No, I do. I think the whole thing. I was talking to an immigrant, young man who lives in Texas, who's quadriplegic. He's in a wheelchair. And his neighbors are kicking him out because they painted the fence green. And the association decided that the green fence was not, you know, they didn't want the green fence. It was not normal. And this guy says, but where I come from, it's perfectly normal. And he's at risk of losing his house.
So
he says in Vietnam, you lived with the knowledge that the communist government could throw you out any moment. He says, I'm in America now. He says, and it's the same thing is still happening. I'm going to lose my house.
Well, that's, in some of the research that I've been doing in other aspects of doing this radio program, I'm really finding that there, I mean, again, this is kind of a microcosm of the macrocosm that's taking place in our world right now.
Yeah.
And are you, in your own opinion, do you like homeowners associations?
No. It's simple. No, I don't. I don't think, in my opinion, there's absolutely nothing in a homeowners association for the homeowner. There is nothing in it for the homeowner.
Wow.
There's something in it for the developer, because the developer is in a position to increase density, thus maximizing his profits. There's something in it for the local government, because they get to collect taxes without actually providing you with any of the services those taxes were originally designed to provide you with. there's something in it for an industry, a cottage industry that's grown up around it, a $40 billion annual industry. There's a lot of embezzlement. In fact, right now in Las Vegas, the FBI finally is investigating associations. They've gone into management companies. They've gone into CAI-affiliated attorney offices and have taken out boxes full of records and things. Nobody is quite sure exactly what triggered this investigation, because a lot of people have been trying for years to get the FBI to look into it, and they have always said that it's a civil matter. It's a contractual matter. You agreed. This is what you asked for. This is what you voluntarily wanted. So find an attorney and go to court and you pay for it, but we're not going to go in and we're not going to investigate. Something happened somewhere and we're not sure what.
Have you found any instances where these were, they had associations that they dissolved them?
They won't allow you to dissolve them, because remember, this is not only, not only is an association good for the, you know, for the county because they don't have to pick up your trash or provide you with streetlights, but they don't get involved. You know, you call the police, they'll say, oops, private property, we can't do anything. So a lot of the other services that you would expect to get for your tax dollars, you're not getting.
So there's a double whammy there, too.
Oh, it's a huge double whammy, right.
Wow.
It's a huge double whammy. It's not... See, there's nothing... You know, when I say there's nothing in it for the homeowner, there really is nothing in it for the homeowner. They've been told that their property is going to be protected, their values are going to be protected. And so Americans are all worshiping at the altar of property values, and that's a false god to be praying to.
That was kind of my impression, but it, you know, you really, it's really hard to argue that with people that have that other mindset.
How many associations, how many people have been slapped with special assessments? And these are, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. And they're asked, you know, they're supposed to come up with it immediately. There's a mindset out there amongst some of the managers and the people who make their living on home, off of the backs of homeowners, basically. And I remember reading an email from a homeowner who said, my association wants $5,000 and I just don't have it. And, you know, they're threatening to foreclose if I don't give it to them in 3 days or whatever. And this manager wrote in very shrill, screeching, how dare you? How dare you even think along those terms? It is your responsibility to go out there and get the money no matter what and give it to the association. It's like, oh, wait a minute. What planet were you raised on? But there's that sense of entitlement.
I am in a homeowners association myself, and luckily it's rather small. And you know, there's a lot of things that can kind of crop up, because a lot of people think each person has their own idea of how it's supposed to work.
Yep.
And you can take the, you know, everybody can be reading the same documents and interpret them differently.
That's right. And that's why the attorneys make so much money, because they have their own interpretations as well.
Right. And
you had asked me whether it was possible to dissolve them. A number of people have wanted to dissolve them.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the local, and there's always, in the governing documents, there's always a way of doing that. The problem is that there's always some kind of common element, and that common element has got to be given to a not-for-profit organization who is willing to take it and maintain it. Mm-hmm. So if you have like a condominium or you have private streets or, you know, a tennis court or a swimming pool, to give it to a not-for-profit who's willing to come in and maintain it for you.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, it's going to be really, really hard to do, mm-hmm. to find someone who will do it. Now, what has happened, and I'll have to go back and tell you a little bit about this, but what has happened is associations that have just gone defunct. In other words, no one runs for the board, no one collects assessments, there are no meetings, nothing happens.
Okay.
And it's gone dormant. And that's kind of the best scenario, except that you're going to get someone who's going to move in at some point, and they're going to say, you know, that Melody always parks her car a little bit skewy, and we really need some rules over here, and we need to clean this place up, and people think they can do anything they want to do, and that's just not right. So we're just going to have to set it up again, resuscitate the association. Well, the mechanism is there. So mm-hmm. you get one person who comes in and says, you know, befriend someone else and says, you know what? You know, this is just not right. I mean, people are doing anything they want to do. They put their trash out before 10 a.m. in the morning or before, you know, the night before. Or, you know, they have two cars and they're only supposed to have one car. Or, my God, they're hanging their laundry out to dry and they're leaving their kid's tricycle in the front yard. Oh, my goodness. You know, people are doing, they're treating this place like their own private kingdoms. They can't do that. Don't they know that they can't do that? And so when you have that kind of a mentality, moving in and saying, we're going to whip this place into shape, you know, they've already got the mechanism. The structure, the underlying structure is there. That's the only problem with just letting the associations go defunct.
Well, actually, I was in one for a number of years that was like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I guess I've almost actually even forgotten that's what I was involved with. And in a, you know, it was out in a rural area, and nobody would even, I think maybe they had 5 or 6, maybe 10 meetings in 20-some years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just kind of ignored the whole situation, mm-hmm. which that was a perfect situation, I guess.
Right. I got a call one day from a city employee in city in Florida, and I got a Popkey or whatever the name of the city was, and he called and he wanted to know how to revive associations. And this was back in the early 2000s, right after 2001.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, you know, why do you want to do them? And explain them to me. Well, they're dormant, they're defunct. Nobody runs for the board, nobody does this, that, or the other. And I said, well, what's the problem? He said, the problem is that they have retention ponds. Sometimes the only common area is a mandatory retention pond. And the retention pond is put in there because they've increased density, so there's no place for the water to go. It's all asphalt and rooftops.
Uh-huh.
So they'll put in these basins, basically, and they'll call it common area, and that's where the runoff is supposed to go. And that's the only common area they have. And he says, they're not maintaining these detention ponds the way we want them to be maintained. I said, well, if they're not up to your standards, why don't you maintain them? Well, we don't have the money. I said, fine, why don't you set up a special taxing district and tax them just enough, whatever it's going to cost to maintain those things, and do it yourself. I mean, instead of hounding people to do things the way you want them to do it yourself and get it over with. Well, there are a couple of other issues, and I said, so describe these associations. He says, well, there are about 40 houses, single-family homes. you know, there's nothing there except for these detention ponds. And some of them have streetlights that have been upgraded. They're not the, you know, your typical streetlights. And they owe us rent on the streetlights, and they haven't reimbursed us, so it's costing the city the rent. I said, wait a minute, you know, why are you renting anyway? That's a whole different thing. Stupid government, you know, not really doing things the smart way. So he wanted to somehow energize these people and get them to reorganize their associations, to resuscitate their organizations. And I said, well, I don't think anybody, it doesn't sound like anybody's missing the organization. It sounds like the only problem is the retention fund, and that's only a problem for you. So I suggest you take care of it and leave people alone. I think they've spoken. Told me he was going around with flyers door to door in these developments, telling people that in order to protect themselves from terrorist activity, that they have to start up their associations again. And I said, what?
The real terrorist organization is the association.
I said, how do you figure that? He says, well, it's simple. They can watch over each other. I said, you don't need an association to do that. I said, I hope someone sues the hell out of me. I said, I'm not telling them it will. I'm telling them it may. I said, well, don't. Because you're lying. It won't do anything. And I said, people need to look out for each other. But I said, it's when you have an association that you lose community. It's a community that will work together and will look out for each other. So don't take that away from them. But anyway, that's, again, my ramblings right there.
Well, now, but I think they're very valid. You've been working with this for a long time and have seen a lot of the pitfalls. And I think a lot of people, you know, if they haven't already fallen in one of these pitfalls, you know, they're certainly out there to grab them somewhere along the line. And I mean, that's valuable information for people. And another aspect that I kind of wanted to hit a little bit more was these third-party companies that manage these associations. Are they kind of like, what do I want to say, franchised at all, or?
There's National CAI Community Associations Institute headquartered here in Northern Virginia, and each state, all of the, I don't think it's all the states, but most of the states have CAI chapters.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a lot of other organizations that do not use the name CAI, but they are all CAI members. They are all industry. And that is designed, oh, well, we're not CAI, we're different. But, it, you know, everybody in them is a member of CAI as well. And they're all industry members. They all make their money by working in associations. They're all the ones that get the $40 billion a year. But they've got them in different states. So you've got, they'll be a member of CAI, they'll be a member of the national, by being a member of the state charter, the state clubs, the state organizations, they'll also automatically be a member of CAI National.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll set up their own. It may be one for just attorneys, it may be one for just managers, maybe one for everyone. California has ECHO, and I don't remember you know, and they have slightly different, I mean, a lot of states have them. They all have slightly different names. We don't use CAI, but they are essentially CAI.
Now, do they have international ones, too?
You know what? The CAI is taking, is taking this to outside. Yeah, they were just in Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia is building these things. The interesting thing is they went to Russia, and my understanding is the Russians basically told them to take a hike.
They already knew what it was like.
Yeah. The Russians are really not interested in this kind of anyway. Finally, they're becoming homeowners. They're not told where to live. They don't have to all cram into it. They're able to buy their own places, and they're not going to have anyone come in and tell them what they can do with them.
Well, every once in a while I watch HGTV and I will watch, I mean, they will always say it in very politically correct ways, but you can tell when these people are going over to, like, Europe or whatever, and they will be looking for a place in the country to get out from underneath the congestion, and you can tell that just by what they do with looking at these homes that, you know they're already told they can't do anything with the exterior of these places.
Right.
So, which is very condoistic. So,
well, that and you know, Europe is a much older society, and some of their buildings are hundreds of years old.
Right.
And they want to make sure that they maintain the integrity. So you have the historic preservation, then you have those in this country as well.
So that also blends into the same idea in a sense, does it not? When you get into a historical district, they start telling you what you can and can't do too.
You cannot alter the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's, I'm not 100% sure. I remember there was a guy in, I can't remember, I think it was Georgia. South Carolina, Georgia, one of these states, who bought a house in a historic district and was told that he could not replace, I believe it was, the front steps. And because what he wanted to do did not quite match what the flavor, the original flavor of the property was and all of that. So what he did was he took paper plates. I think the house was green. He took paper plates and he spray painted them purple. And he tacked on, he didn't paint the house, but he tacked on these purple paper plates onto the house, so it looked like it had a bad case of acne. Of course, everybody had a grand old time. Going back to the historic, a lot of countries do have, the historic buildings, mm-hmm. and there's something really nice about an older house. It's built a whole lot better than anything is built today. And you kind of want to preserve some of that stuff.
Oh, that's what's so interesting about the whole situation is because there really is some, preserving of the flavor of, some of the original building, and when somebody comes in and starts, building, two or three story places next to a neighborhood that was older level, single story dwellings, there is some aspect of that that's preserved in those homeowner associations, but at the same time, it really does kill individuality. There's no doubt about it.
Here's the difference, okay? The difference is that when you go into a house that was built in 1600, that house was a unique house.
Mm-hmm.
It was not part of a big, huge development. That was one house. And it has survived hundreds of years. It has survived the ravages of centuries. It may have survived wars. It may have, you know, survived bombings and earthquakes and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Going into it, you know that if you buy this, you're going to have to maintain the exterior of the house so that it doesn't lose its historical perspective. You do have an option. You don't have to buy that house.
Right.
You can go across the street, down the street, next street over, next town over, and buy something else. With an HOA, what we're doing is we're taking entire areas, huge areas, and we are making everything part of an association to the point where you don't have an option. I don't care if you want to live in an association. I'm not going to stop you. You asked me a while ago if I like them. No, I don't. But I want the option of not living in one. I want the ability to buy something that is not part of one and is not likely to become part of one. That has been taken away. If some people want to go and hide behind gates and some people want to believe that they're being protected by living in a gated development, hey, as long as you know what you're getting into, I don't care. As long as you understand what you're doing, I don't care. I do care when you're lied to. I do care when the stuff is misrepresented. I do care when you're given a bunch of misinformation. I do care when they tell you stuff that, you know, can't possibly, I mean, they can't possibly be able to do that. That's when I have a problem. And when you go to your realtor and you say, I want to live someplace without an HOA, I do not want an HOA, and they can't find you anything, there's a problem.
Uh-huh.
But if you want to move into a development where you have 10,000 houses that all look exactly alike, you better make damn sure you never come home too tired or a little tipsy because you might just walk into the wrong house. You know, that's where the problem starts.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying that people get misrepresented stuff when they move into these things, too? Is that...
You're given, most states now have disclosure laws.
Mm-hmm.
They say that you have to be given a disclosure packet, which includes all of the governing documents and all that stuff. Problem is, you buy a house, it's an emotional purchase. You
mm-hmm.
walk in, it smells like grandma's house. You walk back to the house, and there, framed in the living room window, is the most beautiful sight of the mountains, or you know, whatever it is, you have fallen in love with that house. You are then handed legalese that's subject to interpretation, that's as thick as, you know, enormous. I know some states, some places have really small phone books. You know, I have two phone books that are about 6 inches high. You get documentation that's that big.
Mm-hmm.
And you're given 72 hours to read that, understand it,
mm-hmm.
and accept it. Or, you know, it's a negative. I mean, if you don't say, whoops, we're backing out of there, that it's deemed that you have read, understood, and accepted the conditions. We've already talked about board members not knowing their limits. We've already talked about board members coming up with stupid rules. You know, you don't think about it. Who would think that, gee whiz, you know, I'm walking in, I've got one leg, I've got two tiny dogs, and somebody is going to decide that I can only use a 4-foot leash on this. You know, they change the rules because they have the right to change the rules.
Yeah, so you don't know about the condo Nazi down the road necessarily, so.
Well, here's something else that happened, and this is kind of scary, guys, because even though you're given these governing documents, and let us say that you sat down and you read every word of it, and I've had attorneys tell me I read every word of it and there didn't seem to be anything too terribly terribly wrong with it. What I didn't realize was, and, you know, then they find themselves sort of falling into that pitfall. Several years ago in Florida, Florida's a very, you know, you get a lot of snowbirds down there. People move down there in the winter. They escape the cold north, get away from the snow and the ice, and they go down there, spend a few months down on the beach, and then when things heat up down there and warm up here, they come back up north. A lot of the housing down there, a lot of the condos are vacant. Quite a bit of the year in the summer, they're only being used in the winter time, basically. So a lot of people have bought condominiums and use them as rentals, because sometimes people move in and they have to rent. And these are units that are supposed to provide them for their retirement years, you know, their investments. So they buy these, you know, new association, new condominium is built. They'll buy 2-3 units, whatever it is, and they'll put them on the rental market. No problem. There was a case a few years ago where just exactly such a development, a condominium, decided, you know what, we are going to change the rules and we are going to say that no rentals allowed. So they put it to a vote and they told everyone, oh, you know, it's the renters who are devaluing property. So, you know, if you own a unit in here, you have to live in it. And so everybody voted on it, and it was approved the way it was supposed to have been approved. I mean, it was a valid election, and so they were able to amend their documents. And there were two investors who owned more than one unit, and they did not live there. So they were told, you have got to either move into your units, one of the units, and sell the others, or sell them all. We don't care, but you may not have more than, you know, you may not have rental units in here. And they said, you know what? That was a right that we had when we bought in here. We bought the right to rent out our units, so we are grandfathered in. And it ended up in court, and the court said, agreed with the homeowners, and they said, that's right. They cannot impose, they cannot take away that right that you already had. It's a property right, remember? So the association appealed it to the appellate level. The appellate court came back and they agreed with the second court. They said, that's right, you don't have to move. It was a right that you bought.
Wow.
Association appealed it to the Florida Supreme Court. Here's what the Florida Supreme Court said. The Florida Supreme Court said, yes, you bought this unit or these units with the right to rent them out. However, when you bought these, you also agreed that these rules may change. And nobody is arguing that the amendment wasn't legal, because it was legal. So you know what? Sorry guys, you agreed that somebody may change the rules on you later and you would abide by them, so the rules have been changed. You now have to either move into it or sell your units. So knowing what you get into, looking at the governing documents, is no guarantee that that's what you're going to get.
Wow, so, and that was the one that was upheld, was that particular decision?
That was the Supreme Court who reversed both lower courts.
Interesting.
The Supreme Court said, nope, you don't have that right.
Well, it would seem that they would have been involved in on that election process, too, of the amendments.
Well, you know, this is why I say, for me, it's got to be 100%. But usually, when they first started building associations, there was a supermajority requirement, for instance. I'll give you a for instance in my case. And again, remember, all of these were copied. So everything that was built in that that time frame was sort of boilerplate, and it said for the first 20 years it was, 95% affirmative votes.
Mm-hmm.
Not 95% of the people voting, but 95% of all eligible voters had to vote yes for the change in order to get the change.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Excuse me. After 20 years, it went down to 75%. When they first started writing these governing documents, they thought this was really nifty. Hey, this is great because we've written these beautiful governing documents and we really don't want anyone to change anything, so we're going to write it in that way. You know, it's going to take a supermajority to change it. Then they started working with legislators. Then they started getting enabling legislation passed that gives associations powers and authorities, provided they amend their governing documents to incorporate these new laws. Which is why I say, be careful what you wish for, you might just get it.
Okay.
So now they come in and say, well, you've got to comply with the law, which means that you can change and add all of these other things. One of the changes that they have been making, because it's very difficult to get 95% of the people to say yes to anything.
Mm-hmm.
So what they've done is they've taken it down to a simple majority. It only takes 51%. Because you know what? It's impossible to get people to go along with you when it requires a supermajority. So now they've gone and changed their own rules that they wrote, that they were so proud of when they wrote them.
Because
they were going to tie you up in their desire, not let you make the changes. They knew what was best. Well, guess what?
Okay, well, I guess I would like to get you to talk a little and tell us a little bit about what your program, and do you have anything that, I noticed that you work with, do you write with News with Views, or you just work with some of the writers that work with News with Views?
I should work with them. No, what I have done is I have written some articles for Tom DeWeese of the American Policy Center.
Okay, so
and
it's more with the Freedom Advocates then?
And I probably should do it. There's really not a whole lot of time. I know some of my articles have ended up on News with Views. I know that. And some of my articles have been taken and been published all over the place. I don't know. I don't know how that happens. It happens.
It just gets picked up, huh?
It gets picked up. But my radio show is called On the Commons. It's a weekly one-hour talk show. And you can get the information from my website, which is onthecommons.us.
Mm-hmm.
There is an On the Common without the S, and I don't know who did that, but, one of the things we find sometimes is that the opposition likes to confuse things.
That doesn't surprise me, but...
they want to listen to you. But anyway, it's onthecommons.us, and you can always Google my name, Shu, S-H-U, Bartholomew, B-A-R-T-H-O-L-O-M-E-W, and you'll probably get a few hits for that. I broadcast, my show is cablecast and streamed live on the internet from Fairfax, Virginia, and that information is also on my website.
Well, great. So, one other thing, do you have any suggestions on people before one of these things get put in place as a better alternative out there for people to look at? Is there any kind of a template of something that...
You've got to get involved. Mm-hmm. You've absolutely got to get involved at the local level, at the local municipal level, in your cities, your towns, your counties. You've got to attend the meetings. You've got to make sure that at least, if it were up to me, I'd ban the damn thing and be done with it, because they're more trouble than they're worth, and they really don't do anything for the homeowner. But You know, I realize some people want them. Just make sure that there are alternatives, that there are choices for people, that people understand what they're getting into, that they understand that their house is going to be used as collateral to make the, you know, the amenities run, the collective run, basically, which, you know, goes back to your communism thing. At least if you know that.
Mm-hmm.
Understand also that you cannot fight this in the dark. If you find yourself at odds with your HOA, you will be told by the association attorney not to talk about it. Don't go to the press. It's not because it's going to protect you, the homeowner. It's because it's going to make sure that the eyes of the world are not on what's going on here. There are so many stories out there, but they are the tip of the iceberg because so many people are terrified. If you go to the press and the story gets told, it's going to devalue property. Folks, stop worshiping at the altar of property values. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. And it doesn't protect your property values. We've talked about embezzlement. We've talked about, you know, a lot of associations that don't have the money, especially in today's climate where a lot of foreclosures are happening. The people who don't pay their mortgages are not paying their assessments. So associations are feeling the pinch because not everybody is paying their fair share. They're going to come after you for special assessments. If you pay a $50,000 special assessment, how much is that going to add to your property values?
Well, couldn't that also be a catch them if they were had collateral, were collateralized, and a number of them had foreclosed, that that could really put them at jeopardy too?
It does.
You're right.
It does.
Right.
So you know, that's why I'm saying stop worshiping at the altar of property values, because it's not, it's a false god. It's not, you know, associations do not protect property values. They're not an asset. They're a liability.
Well, Chu, I really appreciate you hanging in there, and we'll get this thing to where I think the people in my my listeners are going to get some good information, and I'll get this edited so that it's got, because you gave us a ton of good information, I don't believe there's a lot of people out there like you that know a lot about these associations, at least in the public arena.
There are a few of us. There's not that many. There are far more people who will come on and tell you how wonderful they are and how they protect your property values. And I do interview them sometimes, and I will go for a whole hour, and they will spend an entire hour telling me and my listeners just how wonderful associations are, how well they protect you, and all of that. My last question usually is, do you live in one? And the answer 9 times out of 10 is no.
Really? Oh, amazing. Well, again, Chu, I really appreciate it. And I hope, you know, in the future that you'll agree to come on again.
Oh, I'd love to. I enjoyed it.
Okay, well, thank you
so much for inviting me.
Oh, well, thank you, Chu. Bye.
Bye.